It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. There are 700,000 military veterans in the criminal justice system right now. For a long time, our justice system has relied on punishment to correct the criminal actions of vets, but this has proven ineffective. Veteran treatment courts provide an alternative to incarceration. They offer treatment, accountability, and structure, and get vets connected with benefits that they have earned. Joining me now in studio to discuss how the program has been working here in Western Pennsylvania is Ronald Scott, a veteran and graduate of the program. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also with us is David Hickton, U.S. State's Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania. David Hickton, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Paul. Thank you very much.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. We'd especially like to hear from veterans about the challenges and obstacles you've had to overcome and answer any questions about this program or if you've been through the program. How did it help you? 412-246-2002, the number to call. More than half of the 2.6 million that deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan returned with mental health issues related to their service, and one in five have PTSD left untreated. David Hickton, describe how this contributes to the difficulty of veterans readjusting to civilian life.
Well, I think it's obvious. I think that when a person pays the price that they do to serve our country, they go into a very stressful environment, and often they come back with a different family situation than they left. They might not have a job. They might not have housing. They have all sorts of adjustment problems. And when you put on top of it that their service may have put them at risk of mental health challenges, it's not only possible, it's likely that they can trip into the criminal justice system. So we're looking to start an initiative here in Western Pennsylvania in the federal court, which would take account for the fact that we have a disproportionate number of veterans in the criminal justice system and that punishment was not the solution to every circumstance.
Ronald Scott, you served in the Air Force and in the Air National Guard, and you had a history of incarceration. Describe what happened to you. I think for a lot of people listening, it's hard to imagine, you know, here's this man or woman in uniform and they are serving their country and they are doing these valiant things. How do you get from that point to taking this dark path?
I think that a big part of it is just selfishness. I think that you look at things through tunnel vision and you make choices because you have a limited amount of choices. So instead of going the right way, all you do is you see when you have problems that you either turn to drugs, you turn to alcohol, or you turn to whatever it is you do. In my case, I turned to crime. And I thought that was the only way to deal with all the issues I was dealing with.
Why crime? What did that was... Was it an adrenaline thing? Was it?
It was adrenaline, and it was a way to lash out at society. Because of my upbringing and being in an orphanage, being in foster care, and just that whole thing, being in trouble in school, I had problems with authority figures, and so that was my way of getting even with society.
How did you end up in the military in the first place? What led you to serving in the Air Force, Air National Guard?
Well, my family comes from a military history, and I really wanted to quit in high school. And my father said, you're not quitting in your senior year unless you go in the military. So that's how I actually ended up in there.
Was your military experience a positive one?
Oh, yeah, real good. In fact, I wish I would have stayed in.
So if you had a positive experience in the military, then was it just lingering resentment over things that happened before that, anger over unresolved issues?
That, and while I was in the Air Force, my first daughter died. And some of the things that happened in Mercy Hospital also built up a resentment that I can now look back and see that. Instead of dealing with them openly, I kept everything inside. And it just kind of came out in the way I retaliated against society wrongly.
So just so we understand, you know, as best we can, how you were thinking or the state of mind you were in, you're going to deal with this by turning to crime. And as you make that decision, what's happening? You know, what's turning you in that direction?
It wasn't a matter of money. I had a great job. In fact, I had more money than I could possibly spend. I had houses. It was just that anger. It was my way of getting even. And it was my way of being in control and showing society that I could just do whatever I want to do whenever I want to do it. I'll give you a simple example. There was a state police area in another state. And just to embarrass them, I literally burglarized every business that actually was a semicircle around them just to embarrass that state police. It had nothing to do with the money or what I got that night.
You were pretty angry.
Yes, very angry.
Let's take a phone call. We have Jared joining us from downtown, so somewhere in downtown Pittsburgh, presumably. Jared, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Well, thank you. Thanks for joining us, Jared.
Thank you. I just want to call and say, you know, how much veterans courts can make a difference. I mean, when you look at the disproportionate amount of, you know, soldiers coming back and either committed suicide or, you know, ODing, you know, which certainly could have been the case for me, and then ending up in the criminal justice system, the veterans courts are a great kind of loophole. I know it sounds like, you know, veterans are getting a pass, but if you look at the statistics with what we're coming back with, you know, it's just too easy to end up in that kind of situation or in rehab or something like that. So, you know, very important.
And it says here that you have a felony charge yourself?
Absolutely. I got several felonies with, you know, no consideration whatsoever for my circumstances, you know, not in Allegheny County, but in Butler, which now I believe have a veterans court. So, you know, they laid a dollar short.
So you're saying this is something that could have helped you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, beyond, you know, beyond anything else, you know, because you can't get rid of those felonies, you know.
Sure. Well, when you hear Ronald describe his story.
Absolutely.
Does that kind of
absolutely.
Ring
adrenaline
through?
Junkie. I mean, I was a gunner on top of a Humvee. And when you come back from doing that, nothing seems important anymore. You know, nothing really matters. You just kind of, you know, in this bland world, you know, that doesn't make much sense. And it's difficult to adjust, you know, especially if you have a tendency towards, you know, drugs or alcohol or anything like that, you know.
Jared, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We appreciate it. David Hickton, you know, as we listened to Ronald describe what he went through and Jared talking about what happened with him, how typical are these stories?
Well, I'm no psychologist, but when we looked to start the court in federal court here in Pittsburgh, we were looking at disproportionate rates of criminal justice incidents for veterans. I think that, you know, we all recognize that the freedoms that we enjoy in this country are provided to us by many people, but a huge piece of that is the people who are willing to serve in the military. And when you, as your caller, just as Jared just said, when you consider that the person is put into a high adrenaline read and react environment through their training, they're taught that they might die if they don't instantaneously react. And they're returned to society and they have all the same adjustment issues that anyone would have returning to society, and they have this new training. You know, to use a simple example, how does a person respond to being cut off in traffic? Generally, all of us would say not well. But if you had served in Iraq or Afghanistan in a high combat theater, I think anyone would understand without any psychological training or skill that a person might struggle in that environment in the immediate aftermath of returning. So these are the things we were thinking about. And then we were looking at the statistics. As mentioned, the veterans have a higher disproportionate rate of suicide. They have a higher disproportionate rate of drug and alcohol abuse. We don't fully understand post-traumatic stress syndrome generally, but it's a diagnosed condition, and And certainly it seems reasonable to me as a layperson that we would have that. So what I found approximately a year and a half ago is there were very few veterans courts in the federal court system. There were emerging courts in the state court system, including here in Allegheny County, and as mentioned, Butler County now, but very few in the federal court system. It's not without its challenges, I want to hasten to add, because our job is to protect the public welfare. And when you talk about a veterans court, we're dealing with back-end reentry at this point. We hope to expand it to front-end reentry, where you might be able to avoid the stain of a felony conviction. But we're not there yet. And in large measure, because we have to create an intake filter so we don't compromise the criminal justice system with allowing violence. Because even veterans like Ronald Scott and Jared would tell you that our first principles is we have to protect society. When they're in this state that they describe, where their anger puts them at odds with living in a way that even they would want to live, they need us in the criminal justice system to enforce the law. But enforcing the law and casting them aside and leaving them no route to redeem themselves is just unacceptable. And that's what veterans court's really about. And Ronald here sitting next to me, I'm proud to say, is part of our first graduation class here in Western Pennsylvania.
That was just this week.
Just this week. I honestly believe it was probably one of the top days I've had since I've been U.S. attorney in the 5 years I've been in the job. It was a day of hope. It was a day of redemption. It was a day of accountability. We had a fantastic speech from Rocky Blyer, who talked so eloquently, as he does, about the importance of the central question we all live with of how can we trust people? And he gave this wonderful grid that I actually printed and put under the glass of my desk that, you know, I think can inform all of your listeners and certainly was inspiration to those of us in the room. And the essence of it is that if you're, A, trying to do the right thing, if you're, B, trying to be the best you can be, and if you're, C, you're willing to care about people, I will trust you. And the frame that Rocky gave us in this perfectly timed graduation speech for that perfect setting speaks to the Veterans Court, and it speaks so eloquently about so many other things. And when I do my reentry work, I sometimes have to make a sales pitch to society about why it's important. And, you know, are we engaging in social work? Or are we doing things that are diminishing our ability to enforce the law? But I have done reentry work with people who I have signed the indictment to charge them. That has happened in the 5 years I've been here. And to me, it's rewarding for this reason. The job doesn't end with calling the foul, declaring a crime is committed, winning the case, and putting people in prison. Redeeming people by creating the structure where they can redeem themselves. And I made the point the other day that if you look at Rocky's life as an example, you know, I was a little kid in Pittsburgh reading the papers when Rocky was hit by a hand grenade, and the papers reported he was through. And I cheered for the 2 years he was on the taxi squad when he could barely walk with only partially remaining portion of his foot. And he ultimately worked himself back to the team and back into the lineup, and we won Super Bowls. So Rocky invested in himself in great, heroic fashion. The Steelers, as a team, which I think is a metaphor for our society, invested in him. And they were rewarded because they and we in Pittsburgh won Super Bowls. That's why I think Rocky is such a wonderful example for this, and his inspirational speech the other day was so important. But really, the heroes to me are Ronald Scott and Jared and all the veterans who served our country so well, have embraced the struggle of life. And I think our obligation is to create the architecture and structure where they can get back on their feet.
And Rocky Blyer, I think, is the only guy who has the Purple Heart and a Super Bowl ring. So quite a guy to have speak at the first graduation. We are talking with U.S. Attorney David Hickton, U.S. State's Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania, and also Ronald Scott, a veteran and a graduate of the first class of the program that is part of the Veterans Treatment Courts, an alternative to incarceration for veterans who get involved in committing crimes as a result of untreated PTSD or any number of reasons after they have served our country. If you have a comment or question for our guests, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. And Ronald, as you got involved in this program, you know, explain how you became aware of it. I'm sure you were probably at your wit's end, and then all of a sudden you find out about this. So how did you learn about it, and how did you get involved in it?
Well, there was a fellow that invited me in to the probation office, the federal probation office, and we sat down and talked. Well, first he had called me on the phone, and then we went through some paperwork. And as he explained the program to me and the things that, at first, I really wasn't interested in getting the help. Then he convinced me, but he also, one of the things he said to me was that participating might help other people also. And one of the things I think is important, and now that I look back at this program for the last 12 months, that I've been helped greatly, personally, through many people that have been involved in this program. But I also see that we helped each other, even if it was just being an encouragement to one another, that we would set these goals and these standards, and then we would meet them. And it was good to see other people, and it was good to see that other people in the program had struggles, but they would overcome them, or they would reach out and get help, or they might miss an appointment, but then they would make up the appointment. And it was just encouraging to me to just keep putting one foot in front of the other. And so, you know, that has helped me tremendously.
And David, give us the details about, you know, how this works, how long does it last, how often do the vets meet, and how many vets are participating?
Well, in terms of structure, it's a voluntary program, and right now it relates to the back end or the supervised period of your post-conviction. The team members include two judges in the federal court, the probation office, the federal public defender's office, the U.S. attorney's office. And I think a very important piece of this is we have partnered with the VA. So we have veteran justice outreach specialists and reentry specialists, as well as mentors. And I want to speak a minute about mentors. One thing we have learned in all of our work is that mentoring works. Whether we're talking about kids who are on the fence about whether they're going to live their life correctly, or we're talking about post-conviction work with reentry candidates, people need help. And the good thing about mentoring, if you think about it from a purely policy standpoint, is mentoring reflects an embracing of the concept that we're all in this together. Whether you're talking about big brothers and sisters, which has been around for a long time, or the various mentoring programs which exist through the veterans or in our work with young children, I think that our mentors find that they get more out of the experience than the people they're trying to help. And I think the people who are the mentees, the people who are getting the structure through the mentoring, I think they find that the love and support that they get from someone they might have never known before gives them the faith they need to trust the society that they're reentering, and it allows them to shed the anger which causes them to operate off the grid. Our Veterans Court structure really has two phases. Phase one is 12 months, and we do an initial assessment and case planning, and we work hard on skill development. This is another important feature, which is investing in people is probably the richest investment we can make. We have a graduation, which we've had, and then phase two considers the new revised supervisory term, and we're working harder during that period to keep the person on the path. So it's a hands-on program with a lot of people involved, but we all have a stake in the same outcome, is that the person can really feel independent again and get themselves on the right track and then feel like they can contribute. Because I think fundamentally one of the reasons veterans get upset is they are making the ultimate contribution when they're wearing the uniform, and they come back and many of them are forgotten. Their lives are upside down, and they really want to contribute. They want to contribute. And that, I think, Ronald would tell you, is some of the root of the dysfunction that happens.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with David Hickton and Ronald Scott. Let's go to Michelle on the South Side. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. First, I want to say congratulations on the beginning of the federal Veterans Court, and I know the Court of Common Pleas in Allegheny County has a Veterans Court that's been quite successful. I've worked quite a bit with veterans over the last one of the concerns that I've had is the lack of funding at the district magistrate level. You know, once they get to Court of Common Pleas or federal court, a rap sheet and an obstacle to getting employment in the future. And the organization that I've worked with, we've seen a lot of people getting drunk driving or district magistrate and looking for funding for that and trying to identify and making sure citizens are aware that we need funding to hit those local courts as well as training officers, particularly the City of Pittsburgh Police, in order to identify and address crisis situations like other cities are doing when they are in crisis. So hopefully, I don't know if you could comment about funding and other places around the country that are getting that and really push veterans courts down as close to the first offense as possible.
Okay, Michelle, thank you. And we'll let David Hickton respond to that.
Sure. Thank you, Michelle, for that question. I think that generally we're trying to be smart on crime without being soft on crime. And there's a whole series of criminal justice reforms that fall under the category of the Smart on Crime initiative. But your question reflects a very, very important point that often it would be better to avoid giving a person the stain of a conviction if we could intervene early. And that would be true with veterans. I think that's the sense of the drug courts that have proliferated around the country, where treatment for the disease of addiction might be better than giving a person a criminal record where they can't get back on their feet. There's another area where you can bring this up, and I think that's in the area of human trafficking. Often the victims of human trafficking are young women who are initially arrested for prostitution. And if we can divert them as victims of human trafficking rings without giving them the criminal record of prostitution,
which prevents them from getting a job that is an alternative to turning to a life of prostitution.
Exactly. And I think society has to understand this debate and has to have this debate, because there are some people who say that if a person commits a crime, the foul has to be declared, and that we as prosecutors aren't doing our job if we don't do that. But I would say in the human trafficking example that I've just given you, aren't we rewarding the traffickers by being too hard on crime and not smart on crime? Now, surely there are cases where a prostitution conviction should apply, but in other cases, not so. I think that's the spirit of the Veterans Court as this evolves over time. A person who ends up with a felony conviction can no longer vote. They often can no longer get the job they might be able to get. And we pay that price as a society. So a balance has to be struck here. And I think the public has to trust that the people who are making this balance, whether it's prosecutors or judges, are making the right decision. But the public can no longer sit on the sidelines in this debate, because when we are very aggressive about being very hard on crime, we pay that price. And we have seen the rise in prison costs, where we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. Surely we have over-incarcerated in our effort to reduce crime. It's now time to be both hard on crime and smart on crime at the same time.
A question occurs to me, and I don't know if it's completely germane to the topic, but I think we should probably ask it, and you're the perfect person to answer it, David. Was the war on drugs in the way that it manifested a mistake?
I wouldn't say it was a mistake. I think there were mistakes made. But it was not my decision to go that route, and that decision goes all the way back really to 1968, when there was a very important commission that was chaired by former Governor Schaefer of Pennsylvania, which was called the Schaefer Commission, and that led to the Drug Control Act of the 1970s. And then another very important time reference point was in 1983, we had the re-upping of certain of the legislation that led to enhancements. And when we start talking in terms of three strikes, you're out, and mandatory minimum sentences, we're making a political and policy decision about how we're going to deal with a society problem such as the proliferation of drugs. And the judgment to be made by legislators at this point is, how's it working for you? Do we have less drugs? Do we have less crime? And that's for the legislators to decide. My job is not to write the legislation. But as a prosecutor who's working in the space of doing my job, which is to enforce the law and enhance public safety.
And you're seeing what's happening.
I see what's happening, and I recognize in the short term that it is as important to prevent crime as it is to prosecute it. And by the way, it's 10 times cheaper. And it's certainly important with reentry, because we know recidivism rates without good reentry programs can be as high as 85% back to jail in 3 years, or they can be as low as 15%. By the way, as they are in Allegheny County under the Allegheny County Jail Collaborative, the best program in the country. And so when we do veterans courts, when we work on reentry, what we're trying to do is invest in people and recognize that who among us can be so bold to look down on someone who's made a mistake in their life? Who among us has not made a mistake in their life? The criminal justice system is not designed to castigate people with the mark of Cain for the rest of their life. It's designed to create social structure. And the way we do it is to deter and punish, but also rehabilitate.
We're talking about the veteran treatment courts, and as I understand it, Pittsburgh second in the nation to come up with this. Buffalo was the first?
Buffalo was the first. There was a program we drew guidance from in Missouri, and there certainly have been good programs in the states, including a very good program in Allegheny County.
Some quick bullet points I want to hit because we're very tight on time, but is participation in Veterans Court covered by VA benefits?
I don't know.
Do we know, Ronald?
In a sense that, like, I would say yes, because all the things that are available to the veterans, you know, drug and alcohol, medical, yes.
Why is there a large percentage of veterans who don't take advantage of their earned benefits?
I think a lot of people don't know about it. And what I mean by that is they have started this program on a computer, and it's really hard to get through. But yet when you're in veterans court and you just speak to the people sitting in the court, 1 week later, everything's straightened out. So when you're dealing with the human people sitting in that court versus trying to get through the whole computer system, it's just so much easier, and you get down the road so much further.
Ronald Scott, how has this changed your life?
Well, one of the things Judge Hornack, the Honorable Judge Hornack, said in one of the sessions was, he said, this isn't about past mistakes. It's about future opportunities. And just sitting here listening to Dave here, like, I am proud to be sitting here, like, with a man that, you know, so honorable, and it helps your self-esteem. I was dehumanized in prison, and I deserved that. And I won't go into any of the details, but they made me feel like a human being again, and they treated me like a human being, and it made a difference. There were people when I came out of prison, nobody would shake my hand. Nobody would give me a job. Nobody was willing to help me. And these people, like, shook my hand. They hugged me. They greeted me. They literally made me feel like a human being, and it helped me want to be part of society.
David Hickton, I'll give you the final question. How successful has the program been with helping these veterans get their lives back on track?
Well, I mean, we're still in the early stages, but we've been very successful so far with graduating the first class, and I think we're going to have more classes to come. And I, you know, certainly think it's a team effort with a lot of people, but the centerpiece of it is the veterans we're trying to help.
It's a great story. It's the Veterans Treatment Courts, and we've been talking about them with David Hickton, U.S. State's Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania, and Ronald Scott, Air Force veteran and graduate of the program. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here and sharing this story, and continued good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And I would like to also thank my family members who did help me when I got out.
One of whom is here.
Yes, my daughter, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for coming in. Coming up, the Jeep turned 75. We'll have the backstory and a little birthday celebration. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Central Pittsburgh, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 75 years ago, in 1940, the small Bantam Car Company of Butler, Pennsylvania, developed an automobile that helped to change the world and shape the outcome of World War II. The Jeep, a true American icon and the forerunner of today's popular SUVs, was invented right here in Western Pennsylvania. Here to tell us the story behind that is Andy Masick. He is the president and CEO of the Heinz History Center. Andy Masick, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be here.
So set the stage for our listeners. Why did the U.S. Army need a vehicle like the Jeep? What were the parameters for production?
Well, think about this for a minute. In 1940, most of the world's armies were still horse-drawn. They weren't mechanized. And the U.S. Army was ahead of its time and thought that it needed a vehicle that could replace the horse. So they came up with specs for a miracle car. It had to be able to climb a 30-degree grade. It couldn't weigh any more than a large horse, 2,000 pounds. It had to be able to pull a cannon. Oh, and it had to be designed and built in 49 days.
So a local company was able to meet those guidelines. But how did that happen? How did a company in Pennsylvania end up becoming, in this case, the Bantam Car Company of Butler, end up becoming the developer and maker of the Jeep?
Well, the War Department sent out an RFP, a request for proposals, to 135 car makers across the country. Now, think about that for a minute. There were 135 car makers in America in 1940. And this little outfit up in Butler was making miniature cars on the British Austin patent. And nobody in America wanted midget cars in 1940. They wanted big gas guzzling American cars. And so this little outfit was about to go out of business. They had purchased the padlocks for their factory doors already when they got that RFP. And those engineers stayed up all night in a Butler diner, and they drew, I think literally on a napkin, the concept for the Jeep. And they designed and built this thing in the 49-day deadline and delivered it to Camp Hollabard, Maryland, for testing by the Army. They were the only company to show up.
Who came up with the name?
Well, nobody really knows where the name Jeep comes from. As early as World War I, old military guys were calling strange vehicles peeps. Then some people think that general purpose, GP, the name assigned a general purpose vehicle, could be the origin of Jeep. Still other historians cite the Popeye cartoon and Eugene the Jeep, that mythical, magical creature from another planet that could do amazing things. So you could take your pick. Any one of those could have been the origin of the Jeep.
And how did this little car company from Butler that was known for producing, as you mentioned, a few hundred roadsters a year, manage to keep up with the Army's demands?
Well, the answer is they couldn't. The war broke out. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. The government said, we need 300,000 of these cars. When can you deliver? And the guys up in Butler said, gulp, 300,000? They had never made more than 500 cars in a year's time in the history of their company, and now they were charged with coming up with hundreds of thousands of vehicles. They couldn't do it. And so the government pulled the contract from Bantam, gave it to Willis Overland. Willis of Toledo, Ohio, was one of the big car makers in America. They made 334,000 Jeeps. They couldn't keep up with the demand for these miracle cars. And Ford Motor Company made another 300,000. And little Bantam, well, they were given the contract for the two-wheeled trailers that tracked behind a Jeep. That was kind of the sop they were thrown for, well, inventing the four-wheel drive Jeep that changed the world.
And what kind of impact did the Jeep have on World War II?
Well, if you believe General Dwight Eisenhower and George Marshall, the chief of the armies and Eisenhower's boss, both of them, when asked what was the most important invention to come out of World War II, both of those men cited the Jeep.
And it's retained the basic design since then, hasn't it?
It's remarkable. Even today, Chrysler Jeep uses that vertical slatted grill with two little headlights as their logo, their symbol for the Jeep. Anybody around the world who sees that knows immediately that's a Jeep. That little four-wheel drive vehicle evolved right after the war into the SUV that everybody drives today. In fact, the Willis Overland Company that duked it out with Ford for the Jeep brand, they started marketing to women after the war. Think about this for a minute. Before World War II, only 10% of American women had driver's licenses. They didn't need to drive. Men did the driving. But after World War II, 40%, 45% of American women had gotten driver's licenses. And in the post-war baby boom era, they all wanted Woody station wagons. So the Jeep company, or the Willis Overland company, designed an all-steel body Jeep vehicle that made the XGIs happy because it was four-wheel drive, but it looked like a Woody station wagon, three-tone paint job, plenty of room for the kids, the groceries, the dog could all fit in there. And that was the birth of the SUV, the sport utility vehicle. Jeep also made little civilian cars that looked like the Army Jeep. They called those CJs, civilian Jeeps, like a CJ5.
The History Center has a new exhibition focusing on Western Pennsylvania's impact on World War II. I heard that you have a few Jeeps on display as part of the exhibit.
Not only do we have a few Jeeps, we have the oldest Jeep on planet Earth. It's on loan from the Smithsonian Institution. It's the Bantam prototype that was made up in Butler, Pennsylvania. It's on exhibit now at the History Center, along with some other Jeeps and other vehicles from World War II.
Andy Masick is the president and CEO of the Heinz History Center, telling us about the creation and the evolution of the Jeep. Andy Masick, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be here.
While its rivals continue to perfect their own prototypes, Bantam's pilot vehicle has run through a battery of tests that would destroy any car. But even when the ordeal finally ends with a broken chassis after 3,000 punishing miles of off-road driving, the military gives Bantam the green light. 70 more updated versions of its original model are placed on order. In fact, the military's tests on the Bantam prototype showcase a vehicle like nothing seen before, either in peacetime or war. While still a work in progress, one officer calls it the most significant vehicle ever developed for military purposes. Despite its small dimensions and unlikely looks, the little Jeep makes an impression from the moment testing starts.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. June 12th through the 14th, Butler, Pennsylvania, the birthplace of the Jeep, will celebrate 75 years of this iconic vehicle. Here to tell us more about the planned festivities is Patty Jo Lambert. She's director of the Bantam Jeep Heritage Festival. Patty Jo Lambert, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
June 12th looks to be a big day in Butler. How are you planning to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the Jeep?
Well, we will be having probably close to 2,000 Jeeps parading in Butler to set a new Guinness World Record for the largest parade of Jeeps.
And do you know what that record is?
Right now the record is 1,864. Actually, the festival set the original record back in 2011 when we had our very first event, and our record was just broken in April, and so we are certainly on a mission to get that record back where it belongs in the birthplace of the Jeep.
Who broke the record?
There's an event called Jeep Beach that is down in Daytona, and it's a big event. It's a great event, but they decided they wanted to have a little competition with us this year, so we're ready for the challenge, and we're calling Jeep owners of any make and model and year to come be part of our parade.
What is it about the Jeep? Why do we love the Jeep so much?
Well, I think that, you know, there's just the whole part of it that it was really credited with helping America win World War II. And so the ruggedness, the ability to use that vehicle to be a soccer mom and take your kids to soccer games or to go out in the woods and drive it on trails, I think there's just a lot of freedom and patriotism connected to the Jeep.
But lots of things helped us win the war. And you mentioned that people have found other uses for it. But there has to be something beyond that. Is it the shape? Is it the history? What?
I think it's just, it's a combination. It is, you know, just the ability for that vehicle to be so, to be able to be used in so many different ways, knowing that it was created, it's an American-made car, it was born here in Butler, PA, and that people just feel that sense of patriotism, and they have that connectivity with other Jeep owners that you really don't see in other automobiles. You see it with Harley Davidson motorcycle owners, but you really don't see it with other vehicles or other models, and the Jeep is really that vehicle that there's just that bond and that camaraderie that Jeep owners have. And it's very much demonstrated during our festival when you get more than 2,000 Jeep owners together and they're all having those same interests, those same enthusiasm for their vehicle. It's really a fun activity to be involved with.
It's interesting when you look at cars, things like Volkswagens and, you know, Mercedes. Almost any type of vehicle has really, the shape of them has changed a lot over the years. The Jeep has stayed relatively the same. How much does that have to do with people being able to identify with it and just having such sentimental feelings about it?
Well, I definitely believe that has a lot to do with the popularity of the vehicle. Everybody recognizes the Jeep grille. They recognize the round headlights. And those pretty much haven't changed too much over the years. There obviously have been some models along the way that they've made some changes. But it seems that you know, that slatted grille that comes back from when Bantam created that slatted grille look back in the 1940s, you know, that's remained unchanged, and that amount of consistency, I think, has really carried through and helped people really have that enthusiasm towards that model.
Patty, do you find that there are a lot of people in Western Pennsylvania who are aware of Butler's connection to the Jeep, or are you doing more and more educating about that?
Well, we're definitely aiming to educate, and that's one of the reasons why we created this event, because we knew that there is so much wonderful Jeep heritage here in Butler County, and we, as the organization who's putting this on, the Butler County Tourism Convention Bureau, we wanted to take advantage of that heritage and that enthusiasm that people have for the Jeep and use it as an opportunity to bring visitors to Butler County. And we've been very successful in accomplishing that goal. This year, in fact, we have people registered from 30 states and Canada. So, you know, it's probably the largest event in Butler County that brings people from out of Western Pennsylvania to attend it. So it's really wonderful when you walk around our activities and you see license plates from all over the United States, even as far as California, Arizona, Texas, Colorado. We have people representing those states, and it's really an exciting thing to realize that you're involved in something that somebody has made that much of a commitment of time and enthusiasm to come be part of.
Outside of this event, how does Butler keep its status as the birthplace of the Jeep at the forefront of public attention?
Well, there's a lot of things that we do as far as just marketing Butler County and Butler as the birthplace of the Jeep. Definitely the festival is certainly one of them. But there's definitely a lot of opportunities for us to continue to share the message about, you know, how a small town America who actually had manufactured other automobiles before the Jeep came to be, that, you know, that kind of manufacturing legacy is here, and we have that heritage in Butler, and that we want people to come experience what Butler County has to offer, and the Jeep is certainly one of those main things.
Patty Jo Lambert is the director of the Bantam Jeep Heritage Festival, which will take place June 12th through the 14th in Butler, Pennsylvania. Ms. Lambert, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA.
To Broadway, full Cincinnati in a Jeep that was built for the six of us. Beep, beep, ha, ha. Beep, beep, ha, ha. This is our taxi cab to Hackensack. We're going up to camp and back and ready. We're six jerks in a Jeep. Six creeps in a Jeep that leaps. Now here we come. Beep, beep. We're six jerks in a Jeep.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Freeburg is the city's one-stop source for all things free of charge. It's now in its third year of existence, and it continues to grow. I'm joined now by the founder of Freeburg, the president and CEO, if you will, of Freeburg, Matthew Spangler, who is here to give us the free three, the top three events happening in the area during the month of June for Pittsburghers of all ages, as well as a spotlight on special events happening in one of Pittsburgh's surrounding counties. Matthew Spangler also works for our sister station, WYEP, and he joins me here in studio. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh, Matthew.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Before we get to what's on your list, describe how Freeburg has grown since you started it.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be here because about just over 2 years ago, April 2013, my first interview was actually with Essential Pittsburgh. And from there, it was just a Twitter account with about 400 followers. And 2 years later, it's over 4,400 followers on that Twitter account. And their other social media networks and Freeburg.com, a newsletter. It's just been growing, and it's fun to see the city embrace it.
So you're saying you owe it all to us?
Well, I could give you a little credit for that for sure. Yes.
Well, and that's about as much as we probably deserve, a little. And we'll take a little. So let's look at the list now. There's a lot going on. This is a big, big month, and
yes.
We have just a few minutes to get through a lot of events. So starting with something that's opening today.
Yes. And like you said, this is a big month, and there's actually something free every single day until September, which is pretty exciting. And today kicks off the Three Rivers Arts Festival downtown Pittsburgh and at the Point, and it's quickly becoming one of the most popular arts festivals in the country. It's a production of the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust and offers a huge celebration of the arts and music, and kicks off today with headlining act Jenny Lewis.
Oh, fun. Yeah. Looking forward to that. And then Allegheny County Music Series.
Correct. Yes. Allegheny County Music Series gets you a little outside of Pittsburgh, downtown Pittsburgh, which is nice. So you have South Park Amphitheater on Fridays and Heartwood Acres Park on Sundays. And you'll find everything from indie rock to country and something in between as well. It kicks off tonight at South Park with Feelin' Groovy with Donna Groom of the Skyliners. And Heartwood Acres kicks off this Sunday with the Pittsburgh Opera. And the entire lineup can be found at freeburg.com.
The Skyliners. Wow.
Yes.
And just when you thought that there wasn't anything to do outside of Allegheny County, we have the Westmoreland County Summer Music Series.
Correct, yes. So if you want to travel outside of Pittsburgh a little bit further, or if you're from Westmoreland County, you do have the Summer Music Series out there at Cedar Creek and Twin Lakes Parks. And it kicks off this Sunday, June 7th, with Wally Ginger's Orchestra at Cedar Creek.
Ah, Wally Ginger, one of the greats. WYEP's Summer Music Festival, I think I've heard of this.
Yes.
Happening in June.
Correct.
Yes. Tell us about this.
All right. Well, it's happening on Saturday, June 27th. Kicks off around 3 p.m. with three performances from WYEP.
And this is at the Schenley Plaza.
Correct. Schenley Plaza in Oakland. And it kicks off with WYEP's Reimagination Project, highlighting teen musicians. And there'll be a children's area filled with activities from a variety of local organizations and an I Made It Market running all night. And the local opener is Brightside, starting at 6 p.m., followed by Kopecky, The Lone Bellow, and Martin Sexton. It should be a pretty exciting time.
Absolutely. In Oakland. Yeah,
yes.
You're bringing – is that a Pittsburgh accent or a Freeburg accent?
Maybe a little bit of each, yeah.
All right, last but not least, Allegheny County Spray Park. This
Correct.
Is where you'll find me. I'll be out there.
Yes, I've been there as well, and it's kicking off tomorrow. All the spray parks will be opened. It's a great way to cool off in the hot summer sun, and since they're free, you can stay for an hour or the whole day, whatever fits your schedule. There's two in Allegheny County outside of Pittsburgh, Deer Lakes Park and Round Hill Park, and then city parks, there are six locations, including Shadyside and Beachview.
All right, so the spray parks, it is going to get hot, great place to cool down. And is there any free food around? I'm hungry. It's lunchtime.
Well, actually, if you sign up for the Mad Mex email lista, if you will, you get a free lunch right off the bat.
I knew you would know something about that. Matthew Spangler is the president and CEO of Freeburg and works with our sister station, WYEP, here with us in our WESA studios today. Matthew, as always, great thanks.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Have a great weekend, everyone. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.